I've been asked to talk about a number of ideas simultaneously, so if I sound garbled, don't be surprised. A group of ideas to do with the self, the mind, conscious, subconscious, unconscious, and various interpretations of the expression the long body. Would anybody like to decide where I should start? Why do we all like the long body? We have a good offer here. We recognize the long body, namely the snake. We are all snakes, we are all long bodies. And we can take an interpretation of any term at different levels. We start from the known and move to the unknown. We look at the biological aspects of the long body first. There is a Buddhist expression about the 6-foot long body. That's for people not under 6 feet, obviously. That means your present physical body. But that present physical body, as we know, is derived from the bodies of parents. And this is going to be our first level of interpretation. Every living being that we know, I think probably most of the people in this room will know about it, have had parents. And the protoplasm of your present body is an actual portion of the protoplasm of your parent bodies. There is no break between the protoplasm of the parent and the child. The mother is born as a little girl with a full complement of ova, about 300,000 of them inside a little girl, waiting to become children, which probably accounts for the behavior of girls in general. When you come to think of somebody walking about with 300,000 invaders inside, waiting for an opportunity to gain birth, you cannot be surprised at the tremendous, if silent, drive towards procreation. Just think about it. Fancy walking about with 300,000 little beings inside you, all wanting out. In order to get what they are seeking, they have to find another polarized opposite half from the male, a sperm. Whereas little girls are very clever and are born with an appropriate complement, little boys have to wait till puberty to start making them. The little boys have to grow tails on theirs so that they can swim and drive towards the recipient ovum of their choice. But the essential thing to remember is this. The protoplasm of your body is an actual portion of your parent protoplasm. An egg and a sperm of the parents came together to constitute your being. So that you, as a protoplasmic being, are actually the growing tip of human protoplasm. Imagine, therefore, because of the continuity of protoplasm from generation to generation, that there is no protoplasmic break between you and your parents, they and their parents backwards. So how long is the long body of human protoplasm? We would have to go back, if we believe in evolution, of low forms into high forms. We could not find a particular point at which we would be able to say this is human and immediately preceding it is a non-human. We would have to go back and say somehow, making me cough to think about it, somehow the protoplasm of our bodies has evolved from a primordial state of a simple monocell into the present complex state of a multicellular organism with millions and millions of little cells. And these millions of little cells are simply subdivisions of a primordial monocell. So when we go back, human, pre-human, the animal, smaller than the animal as we know it, down to the smallest conceivable speck of living protoplasm in the primordial ocean, or even before the sea was precipitated on Earth, when there was humidity in the atmosphere, in that humid atmosphere, before it became sufficiently cool to condense and fall as rain on the earth, there was already the chemistry that was to develop later into our protoplasm. So we must consider millions and millions of years of protoplasmic evolution without a break in it. And that would be our lowest level of thinking about the long body. A protoplasmic factual body, of which the body that we get hold of today, is the living representative. And no break between that now living body and the original primordial monocell, whatever it was, millions of years ago, and no break. Now we're adding to that a simple fact about protoplasm as we know it. Living protoplasm is a marvelous recording material. We know that because we have memory. And the memory that we have is peculiar in this. Whereas with a cassette recorder, you have a piece of tape with certain metal particles distributed on it, magnetized to record a program. And you can put on a very narrow piece of tape, or even on a fine wire, a full orchestra playing heavy Beethoven. Whereas in the case of the cassette recorder, you have the recording of all the formal vibratory behavior. In the case of our human protoplasm, we have also the recording of emotional charges. So we have two factors there to consider. The formal aspect of experience. When you see a triangle, you see a triangle. And you can remember that you have seen a triangle. The fact of that remembering demonstrates to you that protoplasm, the substance of your being, is able to record and to replay its records. And this act of replaying we call remembering, making again a member of the consciousness of that protoplasm. But not only do we have the triangle, but we have an emotive reaction to the triangle. You can demonstrate that to yourself quite easily. Imagine yourself a nice long triangle with a narrow base going up to a sharp point, and then visualize a sphere with no sharp edges on it, and then to test yourself for emotional charge, visualize that this triangle is held by you and strike yourself in the eye with it, and with the other hand take the sphere and hit yourself in the eye with that. Do you get identical emotional responses from the two images? Is there anybody here so insensitive that they can say my responses to both are identical? Can you visualize the point of a needle and imagine it going in your eye, and imagine a pad of wet cotton wool being pressed onto your eye without feeling a difference in the emotional tone? Is there anybody capable of doing it? I take silence as a confession. Is that right, Trevor? Trevor speaks for us all. I know I agree with him, and he agrees with me fundamentally about this. We have emotive charges. Now, to this strange fact, formal records, that's mere shapes, plus emotional charges, we have all the phenomena that we call life. Life is nothing but forms with emotional charges. And the emotional charges are dynamizing the forms. We can think abstractly of a geometrical proposition. And providing we don't imagine doing anything with it to our own self, we can pretend we have a calm mind about it. We can say E equals mc squared and feel relatively okay. But if we say E equals mc squared equals Hiroshima equals 100,000 dead, burned, radiated, disgusting performance, can you feel the same about that equation once you make the linkage? No, you cannot. We know that the fellows that dropped the bomb had great trouble with their nervous systems afterwards. So then we keep this in our mind. Our long body of protoplasm, which goes back millions and millions of years in an unbroken line, records forms of experience. And it records also emotional charges. So we could then think to ourselves, maybe, for the sake of analysis, we could have two long bodies, a formal long body and an emotively charged long body. And we could think of them as two snakes. And we could put one snake on the sinister side there, and that one would be the formal body. All the ideas that have ever been derived over millions of years and kept separate from the emotional response that we put on the dexter side. Emotion means out-moving, and the dexter side, your right-hand side, heraldically is used to symbolize the expression, the pressing out of something. So emotional charges on the right, formal content on the left. We do know this by the fact of repression, that it is actually possible to inhibit your emotional responses to any experience and to inhibit them so well that you can actually put people in gas ovens and gas them without bothering too much about it. We saw that in the heyday of Nazism in Germany. It is actually possible to inhibit your feeling responses. It's possible for you to look at the person you once loved before you married them and look at them with profound indifference. Did somebody recognize that? Now, how do you do this? Because your initial relationship shows a complete interpenetration of the form and the emotive charge. But in fact, we can suppress one or the other. We can have a suppressed emotional charge so that we can do the most terrible deeds to each other without batting an eyelid. Or we can actually inhibit the formal side, that is, not remember the form of the experience, and play the emotional record separately. So that in practice we can actually in act, separate the two records, and we can play ideas from experience and emotions from experience quite separately. So it is legitimate for us to think to ourselves, we can, if we wish, think of two snakes instead of one. A snake counting all the formal experiences with total geometrical configurations, and another snake emotively reacting. And both of these snakes are related to each other very intimately. But the form is not the emotion. So somehow there is something going on in the perception of a form and an emotional tone upon it that allows us to separate them. And that means that they must be actually separable, where actually means that we can in act separate them. We might do it electronically with various filters. We might find out that emotional energy has certain characteristics of vibration different from formal energy, so that we might be able to feed from a human being into an electronic device constructed by our friend Mr. Butler, who is adept in these things, so that you would see on a screen a shape for idea and another shape for emotion. They would be functionally, actually separated. And we could then put a suppressor on either one or the other at will by pressing a button or turning some kind of rheostat. Because we actually can do this. We can turn down our emotional response by act of will, or we can turn down our formal memory of an event by act of will. So our simple long body of one protoplasmic prolongation, a serpent of life, as the ancients represented it. They were very fond of representing life as a snake because of this long body thing. Gives us this strange thing that from the one serpent of life come out by splitting two serpents, an intellectual serpent full of ideas and an emotional serpent full of feelings and emotional drives. This is fact inside any one of us. That is, lifting it up from the level of a simple, non-analyzed life prolongation of protoplasm and dividing it by saying that thinking and feeling are not quite the same in their mode of operation. That we can separate them and we can suppress either one or the other at will. You all know that, because if somebody asks you something and you remember so-and-so, Mr. Duckworth, you remember so-and-so, don't you? I don't have to tell you what search in your mind for that which I'm asking you to remember. And you could say to yourself, I'm not going to remember anything. I can feel discomfort of being required to remember something. And I will expose my discomfort and jump up and down and express discomfort and not reveal an idea at all. You have that power, haven't you, Anthony, to do that. So it is demonstrated, in fact, in us, that we have this dual power. We can experience emotion or suppress it, experience the remembering of ideas or suppress them. And we can do this at will. That is, we can initiate it. The will is initiative. From inside, I can say, I'll just think about a famous trainer of dogs who on TV slaps the wrists, not of the dogs, but of the owners, because they deserve slapping more than the dogs. I can think about her, and I can go on to the idea, yes, he's perfectly right, I'll be very logical about it. I won't emote about it, and I'll say the owners of those dogs have been so badly trained that they're really not fit to train anything at all. And the only thing to do with them is put a choke chain on them and rattle it periodically. And I think that's okay, that's logic. I'm not disturbed. And then I can go and become emotional about it and say, who does she think she is? She's obviously a fascist. She ill-treats human beings and treats dogs with war keys and slams human. Obviously she prefers dogs to humans. And I can work myself up emotionally and discard the reasons. And I can do this by a simple process of introversion, not only in the body, the 6-foot body of protoplasm now, back to my birth or conception, but by a process of deep introversion, I can recapture my mother's and my father's and my grandmother's and my grandfather's idea records and emotional records. So I can emote like my great-grandmother if I want and have a tantrum and fall on my back and show a pink petticoat and many skirts. And I can feel myself doing it. It's only a matter of deep introversion to be able to do this. So then we have millions of years of records inside us. On the one side, the formal aspect of the situation, and on the other side, the emotional aspect of the situation for millions of years. Failure to understand this fact is the cause, the major cause, of mental breakdowns. Because each individual person tends to think that what happens inside his skin is his. He dates himself either from birth or from conception. But he doesn't tend to think that a large percentage, 95% of the rubbish that comes up in him is not him. But it's ancestral. It predates his conception. It goes back for millions of years. And you can have what you call free-floating anxiety. An anxiety that has no object. But you can feel anxious. What about? Nobody's threatening me now, but I feel anxious. I can't see any object attacking me. I can't even see something I've got to do, like enter the Olympics and skate against cousins. There's no cause for my anxiety, but I've got it. Is it mine? Does it date from my birth, from my conception? Or is it long body anxiety? Now, if I begin to detect this fact, that there is such a thing as long body anxiety, I can learn to deal with it. Because then I can conceive that if I take all the long bodies in this room as lines going through space, because we've all got them, with records of the total ancestry of everybody in this room, and that we have each of us got a peculiar thing, a movement of energy inside the nervous system. And remember that rule that when an electric current goes down a wire, it creates a field around the wire, and your nervous lines, the neurons in your body, transmit electrons down the nerves. But wherever there's a current going down a conductor, there is a field around it. And that means you could be sitting there with free-floating anxieties in every one of you, and you could actually feel each other's anxiety. And through sheer bad education, egotistically think that the anxieties you were feeling were yours, although they were undefined. And yet, in fact, they are collective human anxieties stretching back millions of years. Apart from the free-floating anxieties, you have objective anxiety, which is more technically called fear. When you have a known object that threatens you, like a knife or a bomb or a person's fist, or some event that you have to face, like playing the fiddle before the greats of the musical world, where you have a definable situation or a defined object threatening you, that is an objective anxiety or fear. And both of these two are present. We have millions of years of what are to us, unless we go into deep meditation, undefinable free-floating anxieties. But they're not ours. If by myself I'm referring to this bit of protoplasm, and if I have the erroneous idea that this bit of protoplasm started at my birth, or at the very earliest in my conception, and if I don't know about this long body of protoplasm, I cannot solve the problems of my undefined and my defined anxieties. Now, if I can't actually see the realities, the sources of my anxieties, how can I deal with them? We have to diagnose before we can treat. We've still not got beyond the lowest level. We're still talking about protoplasm, whether it's a simple, bi-aspected, or as a dual thing, a form and emotional drive. We're still in the protoplasmic world. Now, let's think about this at a higher level. We put that one on our little finger and say the little finger represents the factual, physical, protoplasmic line of any living individual going back to original ancestry. And we go on to our ring finger and write biomagnetic field on that finger. Gross matter there, protoplasm, chemistry. Here on your ring finger, biomagnetic field. Now let's look at the long body in those terms. All the chemistry of our body is organized by field forces. That's elementary today in the realm of physics. All the forces of the atoms, subatomic particles and so on, are controlled by field forces. And when those field forces are experienced within a living being, we call them biofield forces, bio for life, bios. So on the second level, we're not concerned with the gross chemistry. We are concerned with the biomagnetic power that organizes gross chemistry. And it is this biomagnetic field that is also a long body. It goes back at least as far as the chemistry of living substances. It goes back millions and millions and millions of years. But because there was no organization of chemistry in primordial protoplasm, in the original soup of life, no organization without those field forces. Therefore, that biomagnetic field was there in the beginning. And the biomagnetic field has the peculiar power to record things. You know that because what do you record on a tape? You fiddle about with the electromagnetic phenomena to make a record of a nice Bach cantata. It's only electromagnetic phenomena fastened to that tape that gives you that music. Without magnetism, you couldn't do it. You're a technologist, aren't you, John? Can you record on a piece of tape without using magnetism? It's inseparable. It's inseparable. And mysteriously, it's the orientation produced by the field of the particles on the tape that determine what you're going to get back when you replay it. The magnetic flux orientates those particles, and then when you replay it, you get back what you put on it, namely an electromagnetic pattern. And when this magnetism is associated with living substance, we call it biomagnetism, and it is at least as old as the chemistry that organized the first protoplasm. So then we lift the thing up from the gross level to the magnetic level. When we look at the magnetic level, we say there is a long body. And whereas the electron can be confined to the wire by insulation around it, the field cannot be so confined, can it? The field that is generated around the wire extends beyond the wire, and you cannot insulate it like you can the electronic running through the wire. So it has less formal definition than the electron. You can take photographs with the appropriate electron microscopes of particle tracks flying across your photographic plates. And you can, by various mathematical devices, deal with them and explain what they represent. But when you come to the fields don't have the clearly defined edges that the subatomic particles do. And yet, mysteriously, those field forces are manipulating the particles. So we then have a relatively undefined but fantastically ancient biomagnetic invisible serpent. Not a snake with sharp edges that you can go out and cut up. I know you, snake, I chop off your head and the snake. But something else. How many of you have seen a demonstration of a magnetic flux causing a manifestation like a spark to whip about between electrodes? Doesn't it look horribly, fantastically, frighteningly vital? When you see lightning tearing through the sky, you will be assured by the physicist it's taking a line of least resistance. That's a nice word, isn't it? Line of least resistance. Can you draw it before it follows it? No. Can the scientist? No. You can photograph it while it's moving. If you say, will you please do the mathematics of the line of least resistance for that particular example of fault lightning? You cannot draw it for you and then reproduce it. So in the same way, your biomagnetic long body, the invisible serpent, which William Blake called the invisible worm. The invisible worm. It is a worm of biomagnetic force with no clearly defined edges. Now, having no clearly defined edges, it has no clearly defined purpose. Purpose means pro, positum, that which is put before you, defined for realization by energy expenditure. But if you haven't got any defined edges, you haven't got a purpose, you haven't got an adequately, rationally defined purpose. So you cannot confine your biomagnetic field in the same way. This is tremendously important. You actually have an emotive, inadequately defined, long body of biomagnetic power controlling your chemistry, creating moods in you, producing happiness, misery, optimism, pessimism. And until you know what it is and how to get hold of it, you can do nothing about it. You can't control a thing until you become conscious of the realities of that thing. So there's another long body. When we're talking about reincarnation and rebirth, two slightly different concepts. If you believe in an entity called the soul, if you believe it's a real entity, subsisting in itself, from itself, entering into association with the body, you can talk about incarnation, reincarnation. But in Buddhism, that concept takes second place to another one. A rebirth, not of a soul, an entity in itself, but a rebirth of a pattern. Pattern of desires, pattern of thirsts for existence. Now, can you imagine the concept of the no-self here? Imagine that all power is sentient, feels itself. But imagine that infinite power must feel itself infinitely. Now, how do you feel if you feel but infinitely? Girls know more about this than men. So I'll ask the ladies, what is it like to feel infinitely? To feel without a defined edge? Painful? Pain is a bit sharp for it. It is anxious. Yeah. Pain is a bit too precise, really. No, but it is a real experience, isn't it? It's a real experience. Yes. But there is an awareness. Yes. You have... panic means that nature has got hold of you. And that would require you to define nature in various ways. Panic is a Greek word from the god of nature. And when the whole power of the universe gets hold of you and you can't control it, that's panic. But before that happens, you already have this weird, undefined, undefinable anxiety. The angst of some philosophers. This terrible thing, look at that word angst, A-N, equals snake. G, consolidation of the earth, true Hebraic gimeling. S, T, self-crucifixion. When you feel yourself to be in that anxiety state, you feel tremulous all over. And you're not sure whether you're going to disintegrate and flow away to infinity. And you feel this condition in you, whenever you haven't got an egotistic grasp of the situation, formally. So it is a general background of protoplasm at its biomagnetic level, that there is a paracosmic, beyond the universe that we know of, into infinity there is this strange unease of a non-formulated power which feels itself, but has not yet defined itself. And that goes back to, like the chemistry of the protoplasm, the biomagnetic field, the strings. It's before primordial. Primordial means first order. But before the first order, there is a state of no order whatever. It's chaos. It's a terrible trembling of sentient powers they can't know what they're doing, because there's no K in their vocabulary.
What about in the opposite direction, where there is a feeling that they're coming in rather than dissipated?
Well, we just referred to that by saying egotistical grasp of an objective situation. But we're not talking at the moment about the egotism. We're talking about an infinite, absolute, non-defined sentient power. And because it's power, it's capable of anything. And it is in a state of dynamic, fantastical stress strain without a definition. It's oscillating, behaving a bit like I'm behaving now. Like a comedian on TV after 50 years of saying the same jokes to the same audience and wondering how he's going to be taken this time. It spreads. And if you hadn't got that egotistic body to hang on to, an anchor, you would literally dissipate to infinity. And women know more about that than men do. Why? Because for thousands and thousands of years, men have practiced getting hold of stones and beating each other on their hard parts like skulls to get that objectivity. Men have devised weapons to give them that sense of existence. So in a real sense, because the word existence means to stand out from that infinite anxiety, men are more existent than women. Men stand out in their own consciousness with tremendous egotistical force. They hang on to their identities. This is why men pursue funny things like baronesses, earldoms and things. If only they can get... I saw a fellow, A.J. Eyre, a philosopher, and he had on the screen, Sir Alfred Eyre. He didn't used to have that. And you could tell he'd got it, because somehow he held himself round. He felt like a sir. It's a very useful device, a thing like a knighthood. It helps you to be something. Imagine you're a nobody going like this, and you happen to fix it for somebody, and the next minute you're an OBE. My God, and it says so on the screen. That's me. I'm an OBE. I am not an OBE is. I don't know really, but I am one. It's got a title. So I get hold of my title. And I hang on to it like mad. What does my title do for me? It gives me a refuge, an anchor. It allows me to look at the anxiety of other people and say, I'm not in that horrible state. I know who I am. I'm a recognized being, you know. When I go about, people say to me, didn't I see you in the 39 steps? I feel rather uncomfortable because I wasn't in it. But the shape of my nose is very much unlike the shape of the nose of the fellow that was in it. And there's been a dialectical inversion of nose shapes. So I'm thought to be Frankie Howard or something. And somebody asked me for an autograph, and they say, well, who do you think I am? And he says, Frankie Howard. So I say, okay, and I write Frankie Howard. He goes away identified. Isn't this lovely? This is called cosmic magic. Now, so we have this long body that is at least as old as the universe that we know, plus the antecedents of that universe. But it is a long body. Negroes always go like that when they say long body. They don't say long body, Negroes say long body to get the right feeling. Negroes are remarkably in contact with their biomagnetic field. That's why they're so much better at dancing and rhythmical music and so on. They're actually in contact, they haven't lost their involvement in life. You look at any good singer and look carefully, and if he's got rhythm and if he's got complete involvement, it's probably coloured, because those people have not been torn out of the biomagnetic field by pseudo civilizations. So they're still feeling like life, like beings alive. They're still in contact with that biomagnetic long body, but in the process, how they're not exposed to anxieties, which the naughty Caucasians have talked themselves out of. Because, of course, if you're a Caucasian, properly educated, you don't believe in fairies, do you? Are there any Caucasians in the house? Are there any people that don't believe in fairies in the house? Do we all believe in fairies? Well, I believe in fairies. I know what fairies are. I know that fairies are not in the gross world at all. They're in another world, which we'll come to in a moment. We've got to a point of our biomagnetic field carrying us back into a pre-cosmic anxiety, which is a real experience to babies and women, and which men have defended themselves against with terrible egotistic self-definition. But underneath the well-defended egotistic male, the anxiety is still there. So that he continuously works for recognition and more recognition to make himself secure against what he feels underneath this potential of anxious disintegration. Now, is that the last of the long bodies? No. We have another long body, just like we separated the thinking snake from the emotional snake. We can separate the biomagnetic field driving along from another thing, a mentational process, a thinking process that is exactly as old as our biomagnetic process, that goes back into a paracosmic ideational vibratory behavior. We live in a field of power. The vibrations of that power produce structures, geometries, forms, and the totality of all those forms makes an ideational long body. Because it isn't only this cosmic power in its totality, but it is this cosmic power in its totality of memories of all the states of its evolution. Formerly recorded in the cosmic and paracosmic field. A lot of thinkers encountering it in meditation have called it the cosmic memory. It is also pre-cosmic. Cosmos is only a sphere generated to create a zone of security, a zone in which you can work with relative safety. Beyond that self-ensphering cosmos and permeating it absolutely, there is an ideational field, a field of ideas. Ideas Greek for form, a field of forms, and these forms are continuously moving about. So that at a certain level of meditation, you would be able to see forms moving about in your consciousness. And you would see that they don't belong to you from your birth or your conception, or from your mother or father, but they go back before the universe that you think you know about into infinity, an infinity of ideational structures, all there. Yes, you get into those alcohol and so on, don't you? But it's exactly that, and I don't know whether you've had DTs, experimentally self-induced, but when you do get them, you often see geometrical forms and things. Some of them terribly intense. Imagine what it's like to be attacked by sentient triangles. Never thought of that. Poor old Dylan Thomas was hammered to death with those, wasn't he? You actually see aggressive oblates, aggressive right-angled triangles. And you know they're aggressive because their energy is vibrating like that, hammering on your sensorium and destroying your centers of reference. Because it is a fact that the universe is shot through and through with geometrical energies. A long body, of ideational structures. Middle finger, please. You also put Saturn on that to remind you the middle finger deals with the temporal. And the temporal is simply the eternal moving relative to an observer. Then there's another long body. Now, is that the last long body? No. Because those ideas move in relation to each other. Is there anybody here that's actually had DTs? Is there anybody here that's actually been so canine that they've seen strange aggressive shapes? Is there anybody confessing? I'll assume that you're all decent types. Yes. Yes, even
sometimes
when
you're extremely tired.
Yeah. That's right, yes. Or even in the dentist chair. Mm-hmm. Can't we get her? And you know that because we actually had an occasion on one occasion at least to help a man through that process with a little bit of nitrous oxide, didn't we?
So the sound is very
Oh yes, you hear hummings, don't you? But it's accompanied with flashing lights and weird circles. And they're not nothing, they're energies. Now supposing you thought about those energies as sentient energies, with purposes of their own, so that you're actually invaded by triangles. How would you like to be invaded in the middle of the night by violently vibrating, scaling triangles? How would you like to be invaded in the middle of the night by violently vibrating, scaling triangles? If they've got more energy than you've got, they can shake you to pieces. I mean, literally, they can shake you to pieces. Because they are field forces vibrating. But above that, we have another one. This is a very peculiar one. A conceptual long body. A body of noumena. And here, mysteriously, we change from temporal sequence to spatial extension without temporal sequence. So we now think that the long body we're talking about, the length of it, is spatial. And it's three-dimensional. Spherically expanding to infinity. That's another body. Then we have another body, also a long body, a volitional long body. Because most of the things that happen to us, certainly 95% of what happens to us, is not volitional at all. A stimulus comes to us, and we react before we think about the nature of the situation. And a very small percentage of us can actually inhibit the natural reaction and choose deliberately an orientation. And in the history of all conceivable orientations of that paracosmic power is a volitional long body. Just think that inside you, in your physical body, in your protoplasm, you have all those other long bodies, right up to your volitional long body, which is the totality of all the things, that protoplasmic line from which you derive, has come down to you. And that you are conditioned by the volitions of the totality of your ancestral records in your protoplasm, all your biomagnetic preferences, all your ideations, all your conceptualizations, all your volitions. All your choosings. Now you're responsible for your choosings, aren't you? Are you responsible for your non-volitional reactions? You see? Terrible question, isn't it? Because you have chosen to allow a reaction. This is the occasion of many guilts in people that destroy the balance of the mind, the security of the self, when it recognizes that its own refusal to decide is a decision. That a sin of omission, not deciding when it's within your power to decide, is a decision not to make a decision, for which you are completely responsible. Is there another long body? The hexonic long body. We have to think about that one as containing all the other bodies inside it. It is the body of pure, infinite observation of the totality of all conceivable experiences inside us. Now let's look at one of the little thoughts out of Oriental philosophy, selecting a particular type of long body. The so-called individual human being in Buddhism is not an entity. And yet Buddha himself would not say that at death it is totally annihilated, and he would not say it was totally preserved, because he had a doctrine of the middle way. It is neither totally annihilated nor totally preserved. What is it? It is the record of your karma, your desires, insofar as your desires have orientated you in this rather than that direction. Look at the kama. Kama, K-A-M-A, is the Cupid, the Eros of Hindu philosophy. Quite simply, it means to lock yourself in appetite. It is called the god of love. Not love in our sense working for the development of potentialities of being, but grabbing to fulfill desire. And when you do this, when you car your ma, you lock yourself in your appetite, the K function formulates the M function. The substance of your being, remember, being is a progressive form of a verb, it isn't an entity, it is an action pattern, a process, not an entity, a process, and nothing but a process. And when we talk about you and I and so on, we're not talking about entities, we are talking about processes of desire, which apparently, because of the locking of the appetite, formulate entities. But those entities are not entities. They are appetival self-formulations for the time being. You get hold of yourself, your own appetite, and you form it. And you lock yourself into your appetite. And when you do that, what have you got? You are ruled by the form with which you identify. So we insert a letter R in the middle of the kama, and we have karma. We have the law of action-reaction. We have the law that quite simply says, if you grip onto a situation with your desire, and your desire is you, energy. It is energy. And you grip. In the gripping, you formulate, you close, you encapsulate, and you could encapsulate yourself in various ways. I interlace my finger, that's one way. There's a form of self getting hold of. And here's another way. And here's another way. And here's another way. Whichever way I get hold of myself and hang on to, there is a law in the form. I have a reason for doing it, but the moment I do it, I place myself under the necessity. If I will to get hold of my left index finger with the fingers and thumb on my right hand, and I will not to let go of it, and I manage to succeed, then I have imposed a limitation on myself. So then I say, I will never let go of this. Like a young maiden saying to her first boyfriend, I will love you forever, and I will never let you go. And she won't. And she hangs on. And he becomes 90. And he tiddles. He does all kind of obscene things. And she's only 89. And she's got to put up with this creature because she said, I will hang on to you forever. What's making her hang on? Her appetite. Her definition. Appetital self-definition, does it? But there is no entity there. Just the self-positing of their appetival will to define a situation to make an anchor. I have this infinite anxiety. I don't like it. What do I do? Get hold of something. What? There isn't anything to get hold of except appetival power getting hold of itself. Because absolutely there isn't anything except power. Sentient power. So when you get hold of something, what do you get hold of? You with your decision to hold. And then you pay the price of your self-definition. How can you avoid paying the price if you lock yourself up? You can design for yourself a concrete box, can't you? You can go in through the top where you left a hole, and you can make it tall enough so you can't reach the hole, and you can hang with your fingertip and then drop. But you can't get out of it. Until somebody else takes your concrete box to pieces for you. And that is self-imposition. So in that Buddhistic view, there is a new view of the long body, that the long body is nothing but the totality of all the thirst for life, the hunger for experience that you have ever had and patterned by your own self-choices. It isn't an entity. But it is energy. And wherever you go, you, meaning the affirmed situation into which you've driven Y-O-U, the energy captivates itself, punishes itself by its own self-limitation. Punishes from punire, to negate power. How do you negate power? Quite simply, define it. And then hang on to the definition. The intuition life, well, that has many different usages. One word, one use of the word intuition, a scientific one, is that you intuit any sense datum. That's an intuition. Any immediate, not rationally thought out information is called an intuition. And that's not what you were meaning, is it? Intuition, as you've used it here, really is internal teaching. The center of your being has no spatial dimensions. And infinity presses on that point, changes itself according to the needs of the organism, and then feeds from infinity inwards into a point, and then through that point to the periphery of your skin. And tells you something that your empirical ego cannot know. No. Unless by body, you meant something that body is not supposed to mean. Namely, infinity power. Does body mean infinity power? It's a misuse of B and D. B means encapsulation and D means division. There is no division because infinity has no end. Presses in to itself, creates the center, presses out to a periphery which it generates. And there is no division. That's intuition. It is non-body. In Buddhism there are three bodies under great consideration. But the use of that term body, certainly the English term body, because there are other terms, would not cover the fact. Take another word, translated body, kaya. K-A-Y-A. It simply means lock affirmation. There are an infinity of possibilities. I can focus my eyes on that young fellow who is the brother to Anthony Duckworth. When I've done it, I've gone, kaya. I've locked on the situation. And that is a kaya, a body. But the body only means the zone in which I have decided to focus. There's no reason at all why we shouldn't focus on Trevor, or Dr. Wadsworth, or anybody. With the same fervour and the same energy that I concentrate on this organism here, I can concentrate on Deb's organism. And if she's a bit vague, I concentrate so hard on her, I can pick her arm up like that, and she would feel that she'd picked her arm up. Because only your focus determines where that power operates. You can share that with relatively new babies in a cot by looking at a limb and then just feeling it up and it will move. Babies are less dependent than civilized people. You can do it with the ears of a cat, very simply. Gaze at the back of the sleeping cat and go to its ears and go around its ears mentally and they will twitch. Usually you're so happy with your egotistic physical self-reference because it has rescued you from the infinite anxiety that you cling to it as a support for your consciousness to stabilize it, and you treat it as an entity when in fact it's a process. You know it's a process because food is going in at one end and coming out at the other all day and all night, isn't it? Drink is going in and perspiring out. What are you? And if you photograph yourself on a proper camera with sensitive materials, you'll find you're nothing but a vortical centre of input-output. So what are you? Answer, process. Is it a finite process? No, it is not. It's an infinite process. But the moment you say, I'm infinite process, oh, anything can happen. I might do anything, do you know that? If I allow that, if I allow that I'm an infinite potential and I could do anything whatever, what's stopping me doing it? Only the rotten training I've had that's inhibited me by terrorizing me in the body called society. I might go down there and sit on Greta's knee. She thinks it's Greta's knee because she's used to it. I don't think it's Greta's knee, I think it's my knee. And she's allowed to use it if she takes care of it. I don't mind. But it's only her driving energy in that place that has made Greta's knee. Would you believe she's modeled her own kneecap? It's true. Every form you've got, you have modeled yourself by your own intention. You've taken a primordial fertilized egg of protoplasma jelly. And my terrible concentration. Have you seen babies photographed in utero? They're all like this. They're like Rodin's thinker, aren't they? That's yet a bit clearer in that expression. He looks puzzled. They don't. They just look terribly convergent. I'm just modelling myself. I'm going to be a man or a lesbian or a queer or a drag queen or something. And the decision that they make is made at a particular stage in a long body of protoplasm, of biomagnetics, of mentational, conceptual, volitional, and overseen. All kinds of decisions are made there, in that baby. And you can't see a good photograph of a baby in utero without saying that little horror is concentrating. And it's growing itself things like heart and liver and kidneys and spleen, and recalling the old long body pattern of human evolution. So if we then say to ourselves, I see, rebirth is the entrance again of a pattern, not an entity, into expression. The pattern of force is a desire, self-locked, self-orientated. Reincarnation is the concept that there is a permanent entity called a soul that goes into bodies, and then the body's down, leaves and goes out, comes back again. The whole thing is under the authority of appetite, self-defining. I'm saying you can view the word soul as an entity which would place you more or less in the European context, or you can view the word soul as a convenient term for a process of energy. That would be a Buddhist view. Of course, there's not only one form of Buddhism anymore, there's only one form of Christianity. But within the large field, the doctrine of non-self, the anatta, the anatman, the not-self, means there is no entity that is finite, and that you could correctly name a soul separate from other souls. If we want to know what the real self is, we go to an equation expressed in the Sanskrit of Atman, the self, equals Brahman, infinite extended power. In which case, when you identify with your physical body and think that that is your identity, you're suffering from empirical egotistic conditioning. But if you lift yourself up progressively to the overseer level, you climb from your physical body through your like, dislike, your mentation, your conceptualization, your volition, till you identify pure consciousness without an edge, and then say that is the self, then you cannot say that there are many selves. But neither can you say there is only one self. Because when you say one, you draw a line around it. So you just say it is the extended, the Brahman, the extended sentient power. When you identify with that one, which transcends itself, because when it draws a circle, it does so to make for itself a zone called sacred place for identification, for stabilization of this pre-cosmic anxiety. But it isn't there, really, other than as an intent to make such a zone. So what are you, then? If you feel and think and will simultaneously, that's called triumph. Triumph means your threefold, substantial positing of a hierarchy of powers. When you triumph in that way, you think and feel and will absolutely coincidentally in the place where you are from infinity. You posit yourself. Now, in actual fact, owing to the vibratory nature of so-called matter, you do disintegrate and reintegrate every instant of time. So the Deb I was speaking to a few seconds ago is not the one that is there now, because some energies have come in from the infinite and some have gone out. She's changed her mind. She gets a new view. She's a different complex. Why should I assume I know her if, in fact, she's changing all the time? By Dunlay Mobile, and so is everybody else. We are living inside an infinite ocean, a fluxion of sentient power, which is not an entity at all. Then how did the word entity get into the language? The answer is that originally it did not mean what it came to mean. It came to mean the egotistic property conscious being only later. The word actually means life field crucifying itself and affirming its self-crucifixion. That is what entity means, but that's not at all the way people think about it, is it? Because you think an entity is a sort of thing in itself, whether it's inorganic or organic. It is something in itself. Its existence is in itself. And that's an entity. And that's not what he means. It means that infinite life looks inside itself, like the baby concentrating in utero, and posits for itself a point of reference, and nails itself on that point, and affirms the fact that it has nailed itself on the point, although in fact it is infinite. It posits finite references, but it is infinite. And only that infinite is the real meaning of self. The very word self tells you it's a transcendent word. It's got an S of one end and an F of the other. Both letters signify leakage, a transition from one state to another state. The S squirts, the F leaks. You get an ordinary bicycle pump, and you get hold of the pump at the end, and you put your finger on the end and hold it very tight, and you pump very hard. When you're pushing the thing, you can see the rod going in, and then you find your finger getting hot. And you say, yeah? That pump expresses exactly the meaning of the word self. From the infinite comes a tremendous spiritual power, sentient power, and it pushes itself into a driving tube, a helical drive, and it grabs the end of it and says, I can't let you out. Then there's an infinity of power saying, I've got to express myself. And this one says, well, I don't want to express myself. So the one end is arguing with the other. You know, there's a little stalk connecting the two sides of the brain, but if you cut it, you know, you can actually do, you can train a person or an animal so that the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain give contrary orders. So you can actually train a person to pick up a cup to drink and the left hand to pinch the cup from it and take it away. That's a factual experiment. You think that's strange when everybody is doing it every day of their lives. They want to get hold of this and something stops them. And they feel this terrible tension full of, I'm a free being, you know, I can do what the hell I like. I can do anything, I know I can feel it, so I will do it. But somehow the hand won't go out and get it. It sees a notice, grapefruit, 65p. And instead of saying, what comedian put that notice there and taking the grapefruit and eating it, your training gets hold of you. You say, oh, that's called the price, you know, and you go like this. I see, what's that? That's a toffee paper. I wonder if that will do. So you go to the man who is watching you with suspicion, and you say, I'll have the grapefruit, please. And he holds his hand out, and you go like this. That's paper, he says. Toffee paper, yeah. I want to buy the grapefruit. But I don't sell grapefruit for toffee papers that have been used. I want coin of the realm. I have no coin of the realm. I'm a sentient being. I'll just take the grapefruit, never mind the coinage. He says, how am I going to live? And you say, does everybody do this to you every day? Because if not, you can afford to give it to me. And then his generosity impulses come out. Where are the police? This is actuality. Infinite appetite has created itself lots of long bodies. And there are no entities in the sense of private self-beings. The only true entity is infinity itself, a life process, crucifying itself on forms to stabilize itself, to rescue itself from an absolute anxiety. Now, how does that make you feel? How do you feel? Well, isn't it true? The cause of the anxiety can only be that you're not quite sure of your ankle. Right? You know, Christians say, Christ, my anchor. And Hindus might say, Krishna, my anchor. Some people might say, Paul, my anchor. Sorry about that. and ko means snake, that's appetite, plus kor, which means hierarchy. And ko means I know my appetitive power establishes a hierarchy in itself. I don't go looking outside. There is no outside infinity. Do you set up a hierarchy of preferences, an order of precedence in yourself of what you will to do? Have you done that? Have you defined it? Well then, if you define that adequately, your security is there. You say, these are the things I intend to do. These are the prices I'm prepared to pay, beyond which I will not go. And the moment you're sure about that, your surety... Why? It is only volitional... Oh, that's why. When you review it and find that it's really true that you posit your own mode of appetitive self-trapping... What have you got to worry about? I am my own executioner. True. Now how do you feel if you accept tentatively for a moment this hypothesis that every being in this room is an infinite sentient power that has generated for itself, internal to itself, a body of reference aimed at establishing security of tenure of a governing concept. Like it? I like it. Are there any beings that don't like it? I know it's uncomfortable because it throws total self-responsibility on us. Who can we blame? We have no ground of complaint against husband or wife or children or parent or society or rotten government or trade unions. We have no ground of complaint against anything, anywhere. Because we are here in the situation in which we have put ourselves.